Hello there. Today is Tuesday, March 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the UK says it's certain the poison used in a murder attempt on a former spy came from Russia.
And they're more deadly than even VX, which is one of the most deadly nerve agents that we know of.
North Korea has yet to respond to President Trump's acceptance to meet face-to-face with Kim Jong-un. The opioid epidemic continues to take more lives in the U.S.
I believe it's been about a 200% increase in the death rate over the last 15 years.
Also ahead, the South by Southwest Festival in full swing in Austin, Texas. We'll tell you all about it. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the White House is stopping short of blaming Russia for the poisoning of a former Russian military intelligence officer who was a double agent for Britain's intelligence services. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders told reporters Monday that the U.S. stands by the U.K., but didn't share in London's strong accusations toward Moscow for the March 4th poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in Salisbury. Both remain hospitalized in critical condition.
The use of a highly lethal nerve agent against UK citizens on UK soil is an outrage. The attack was reckless, indiscriminate, and irresponsible. We offer the fullest condemnation, and we extend our sympathy to the victims and their families and our support to the UK government. We stand by our closest ally and the special relationship that we have.
British Prime Minister Theresa May told Parliament earlier in the day that it's highly likely Russia's responsible for the attack with a military-grade nerve agent, and that Moscow has until Wednesday to respond.
Russia's record of conducting state-sponsored assassinations and our assessment that Russia views some defectors as legitimate targets for assassinations, the government has concluded that it is highly likely that Russia was responsible for the act against Sergei and Yulia Skripal.
May said there are only two plausible explanations as to what happened.
Either this was a direct act by the Russian state against our country, or the Russian government lost control of its potentially catastrophically damaging nerve agent and allowed it to get into the hands of others.
Well, joining us now to talk more about this, national security expert Jamil Jaffer. Jamil, what do you make of this strong accusation by the UK leader?
What's clear about this is the term that Theresa May used to describe this set of chemicals. It's called Novichok, and it's a set of chemicals created by a Russia, or some nerve agents, I should say, created by Russia in the 1970s and 80s. They're an organophosphate compound, and they're more deadly than even VX, which is one of the most deadly nerve agents that we know of. And these are unique to Russians. So either they were used by the Russians here or were stolen from Russia, even more troubling, and used by somebody against a former Russian spy. It seems sort of unlikely that somebody's going to steal Russian chemical, or nerve agents, and then use them against a former Russian spy. You know, Russia has a history of poisoning its enemies, including in England from Georgi Markov back in the 1970s, who was poisoned with the tip of an umbrella, to Alexander Litvinenko in 2006, who was poisoned with polonium 210. And so Russia has a history of doing this. This is a Russian-specific compound, so it seems like the attribution of Russia is probably pretty clear here.
So why do you think that the White House is stopping short of blaming Russia for the poisoning?
You know, it's a great question. We've seen this happen before with the Russian influence in our elections. Clearly now, there's no question that the Russians attempted to mess with our elections, to undermine our confidence in our electoral system, and to sow discord and dissent amongst Americans. And yet, over the course of the campaign, and even recently, the president has expressed some skepticism about the Russian role, at times talking about hid in his basement or the Chinese. But now it's clear. I mean, the House Intelligence Committee itself is about to release a report that makes clear the Russians did attempt to interfere in our elections, and that's troubling. And so it's important, actually, now that we know the Russians did that. We know what the Russians are doing here in England. We know they invaded Ukraine and took over Crimea. The time has come for the United States to take a stand and say enough is enough, because Vladimir Putin responds to power. And in the absence of an assertion by the United States and by the British, a very clear assertion and, frankly, a response, Putin will continue to press his advantage.
This is a nerve agent that literally was made by Russia. But how does the British investigation, how do they determine what the nerve agent was? How do they go about pinpointing it that closely to where it came from?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the exact composition of this compound isn't known. We know that the British, like the United States, have very sophisticated scientists work in this space. They do this work at a place called Porton Down in England. Now, the general chemical structure of these agents was made public back in 2008 by a Russian scientist. They at least have it on good enough authority for Theresa May to make that claim publicly in front of Parliament.
Do you think at some point, if there is even less uncertainty about where this came from, do you think it will become even more important that the U.S. strongly condemn Russia?
Well, I think at this point it is critical that the United States come out aggressively and condemn all manner of Russian activities, from their continuing activities in Eastern Europe, their attempts to influence our elections to date, their ongoing covert influence campaign against the American public, and potential concerns about the American election, putting to one side these activities in the West where they're poisoning people. And so the time has come for Western nations, the United States in particular, but all of our allies, to stand up and say enough is enough. We won't take this anymore, and to take real action against the Russian regime and against Vladimir Putin himself personally and against the cronies that he surrounds himself with to keep him in power, these Russian oligarchs.
All right. National security expert Jamil Jaffer, thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. With the serious ceasefire of failure, the U.S. proposes a new resolution. House Republicans closed their Russia investigation, saying there's no evidence of collusion between Trump and Russia. An uncertain fate awaits Syrian civilians hiding in underground shelters in eastern Ghouta. An Ethiopian disability rights advocate champions opportunities for women. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, the U.S. said Monday it has yet to hear back from North Korea in the days since President Donald Trump agreed to meet in person with Pyongyang's reclusive leader Kim Jong-un. The U.S. National Security Advisor said Monday that Washington will keep its policy of maximum pressure on North Korea. H.R. McMaster was in New York to brief ambassadors of the 15-nation U.N. Security Council, as well as Japan and South Korea.
We all agreed that we're optimistic about this opportunity, but we're determined. We're determined to keep up the campaign of maximum pressure until we see words matched with deeds and real progress toward denuclearization.
The U.S. said earlier Monday that it has yet to hear back from North Korea since Trump agreed Thursday to meet in person with Pyongyang's reclusive leader. McMaster didn't respond to reporters' questions on that. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Harry Kazianis, Director of Defense Studies at the Center for National Interest, if he's surprised U.S. officials have not heard back after the president's stated willingness to meet with Kim.
I am, to be honest with you. To offer such an unprecedented opening to the United States through South Korea, one would expect them to be forthcoming, to either put it in their propaganda organ, to illustrate it in some capacity. But to not say anything just yet makes me a little leery. It also makes me think that the North Koreans have some sort of strategy to get, you know, some sort of bribe, financial inducement, or some type of sanctions relief before they enter talks. And that would be the North Korean playbook just dusted off in the 2018 version. So I think the Trump administration is smart to be sort of leery, to be a little bit of cautious, and to see what happens next.
There's been a lot of buildup since this stunning announcement was made last Thursday. Are people overreacting to the prospect of talks? They might not actually take place.
I think it's human to overreact in this particular situation. Just going back to last year, I mean, there were so many different times where we were literally close to the brink of war. Every ICBM test, every medium range test, one of those had went bad and landed in South Korea or Japan or injured people, we probably would have been in some sort of state of war. So I can't blame even the most seasoned experts on North Korea to get excited about this. I'm pretty excited about it myself, to be honest with you. But I think we have to take this with a grain of salt. And I think we have to remember, this is literally act one of a five-act play, and the curtain is literally just gone up. So we're going to have to be cautious and see what North Korea actually agrees to do. Then I think we'll have our answer.
H.R. McMaster, briefing U.N. Security Council envoys Monday in New York, said, quote, "We all agreed we're optimistic about this opportunity, but we're determined to keep up the campaign of maximum pressure until we see see words matched with deeds and a real progress toward denuclearization.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. In the past, every time North Korea has offered the littlest bit of hope on this situation, which usually means some sort of talks, the United States and its allies would always, of course, offer some type of financial inducement, or the North Koreans would ask for it. And the North Koreans, to their credit, they pocket the concession every single time. They'll go into talks with the United States and its allies for months, sometimes years. Nothing gets resolved, and North Korea goes on its way in developing nuclear weapons and missiles. So I think the Trump administration is doing what it can to break this cycle of behavior, to make sure the North Koreans know that they're not going to get away with that again. And I think that strategy, if we're going to get to a point where the North Koreans do agree to some sort of timetable on denuclearization and actually get there, this is the way to do it.
A spokesman for South Korea's Unification Ministry, referring to the North Korean silence up to this point, said, "I feel they're approaching this matter with caution and they need time to organize their stance."
I wouldn't completely disagree with that, but this isn't something that can go on for weeks. It seems like there's been at least some sort of preliminary agreement or straight line talk that this summit would happen by the end of May. There's a lot that needs to happen in those few weeks to get to that point. The United States and North Korea are going to have to figure out where they're going to hold the summit. And we all know that any type of summit like this, the deal is going to be struck before the summit happens, because there's no way that Washington or Pyongyang is going to go to a summit like this and just sort of throw it on the two leaders to figure out some sort of deal within a few hours or 2 days maximum. There's no trust between the two sides. They don't know each other. They don't know how their personal chemistry is going to match. And there's just no way that you can somehow paper over decades of problems within literally potentially hours. So there is a lot that would need to happen between then and now, and it's incumbent on North Korea to start making that happen.
How likely is this whole thing a ruse, and that North Korea is just simply deciding to talk because it's already reached the threshold of being a nuclear power?
That's very possible. I mean, the thing is that we're all forgetting is the North Korean missile and nuclear programs continue building up. Just because you're not flying missiles in the sky, just because you're not detonating nuclear weapons, doesn't mean the R&D is still continuing on. It doesn't mean the scientists aren't testing their different types of nuclear weapons on massive computer simulators. The work continues. So every minute that we're not negotiating with the North Koreans or putting even more pressure on them, that means they've gained valuable time to build up their nuclear weapons. So it is very possible that this is some sort of ruse. That's why it's incumbent on the Trump administration to push them to see if these negotiations are real, but also set up some very important preconditions.
That's Harry Kozinas, Director of Defense Studies at the Center for National Interest. Students across the country have been protesting school gun violence since the February 14th mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, that left 17 people dead. On March 14th, the one-month anniversary, a national student walkout is planned to last 17 minutes in commemoration of the victims and as a statement to policymakers. From Washington, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
A national movement sparked following February's high school shooting in Parkland, Florida, in which 17 people were allegedly killed by a former student wielding an AR-15 semi-automatic weapon. For the one-month anniversary of that event, students, teachers, and others from around the country will take part in a 17-minute walkout to honor the victims and draw attention to the issue of school gun violence. On Thursday, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio met with students to discuss the topic. Some of them emphasize student activism as a way of bringing in fresh voices they say are not controlled by the National Rifle Association.
As I turn on the TV and I see all of these mass shootings that I know could have been prevented, I feel like it's my job as someone that could have happened to actually take action and go into that leadership role.
While others signal their support of responsible gun ownership and the Second Amendment, which provides for gun rights in the U.S.
You never know the moment when an armed person can come in. And when an armed person comes in, we need to have somebody ready, such as a school safety officer that is armed and ready to initiate and either like take down the person or maybe even kill the person for the better safety of all the other students.
A march in Washington is planned for March 24th. And another walkout is scheduled for April 20th, the anniversary of the 1999 shooting in Columbine, Colorado. Some school districts have announced they will not recognize the walkouts and will discipline those who participate. Others have offered their support. with some colleges reassuring students that admission offers will not be affected by their participation. Jill Craig, VOA News, Washington.
Continue to speak out!
To continue to speak out!
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Opioid overdoses jumped 30% from July 2016 to September 2017 in 52 areas across 45 U.S. states, according to a new report by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Opioid overdoses increased in the Midwestern region by 70% over the same period and spiked 54% in the largest cities in the country. The report said that the figures provide an early warning for health departments to coordinate a response. President Donald Trump recently declared that the use of addictive opioid painkillers is a national emergency. But experts say such a declaration means little unless new funds are made available to fight the problem. Joining us now to talk more about it is Harry Nelson, head of the American Addiction Treatment Association. Thanks for so much for being with us. So this is a very disturbing report.
Anybody who thought that we were at a peak of the opioid crisis, death toll this past year was just under 64,000, according to the Center for Disease Control. For 2016, that was the last reported year, is thinking again, right? These numbers that are coming out of the Midwestern states are blowing way past worst-case scenarios in terms of the growth of this problem. And so we're now looking at the very real possibility of 250,000 Americans a year dying from the opioid crisis. So what it says to me is that we have not even begun to get our hands around the full scope of the problem and how to address it.
Why do you think the Midwestern region has such a huge proportion of this problem?
It's not clear to me why the Midwest in the latest instance. We've seen in general that the hot zones for the opioid crisis, places like New England in the past, West Virginia, Ohio, have been places with higher rates of unemployment, arguably with sort of less social capital and worse networks of people supporting each other. That's a theory that's out there, and maybe that explains what's happening here. A more cynical view would simply be that the criminal organizations that are trafficking in heroin and increasingly in fentanyl have been more effective at getting into the Midwestern states, and that what we're really seeing is that as doctors are getting much tighter about prescribing and pharmacies are getting stricter about limiting access to prescribed opioids, we're seeing patients in pain turn to illegal sources. And the problem is that these drugs are dangerous. There's a very slim margin of error in terms of respiratory suppression. So my belief is that we're seeing the byproduct of people who become addicted, become dependent, and have a higher and higher tolerance and killing themselves in many cases accidentally.
So in other words, these are people that probably were initially prescribed this for some sort of pain, whether it be post-surgical or some other reason, and unintentionally became addicted.
That seems to be the predominant pathway, is that people have some instance of pain, they get some treatment, but then in the process of getting prescribed an opioid, whether it was OxyContin or one of the other opioids, they become dependent and can no longer get it from their physician. Physicians are afraid of state medical boards. Pharmacies, likewise, are cracking down, and so people are turning to these illegal sources.
Is it safe to say that this epidemic has worsened?
I think that's the message. I mean, even before we got the latest data, we were seeing the year-over-year death tolls have been going up at a pretty steady pace. I believe it's been about a 200% increase in the death rate over the last 15 years. But what we're seeing in the latest data is if this trend holds up, we're seeing an acceleration of the increase, meaning like the death rate. I think the death rate for 2015 was in the 50,000 range, and now we saw 2016 data going ahead of 60,000. And if we're going to see a jump of 100% from year to year, we're going to get much, much faster to hundreds of thousands of people dying every year.
Why do you think it's gotten so much worse?
The problem starts with understanding pain. We have an unprecedented level of pain reporting. There's an underlying pain epidemic that physicians don't know how to deal with. And so opioids became an easy solution. Giving somebody a pill that dealt with their pain was an easy solution until the problem of addiction and overprescribing got so much attention. And the problem is that we don't have resources in our healthcare system to focus on alternatives. We don't have physicians who are trained to treat people in non-medical ways in the numbers that we need. We don't have dollars in health plans to pay for the kind of care for non-medical solutions. So I think there's a lot of work to be done, both in terms of developing solutions, non-opioid solutions, training physicians, putting money into the system. I think this is a massive effort that, frankly, is likely to take many, many years for our system to address effectively.
All right, Harry Nelson, head of the American Addiction Treatment Association. Thanks for being with us. Austin, Texas police Monday said three package bombs left outside the homes of two African Americans and an elderly Hispanic woman are linked. One of the bombs killed a 17-year-old boy Monday, while a second wounded the 75-year-old woman. Another booby-trapped package killed a 39-year-old African-American man on March 2nd. The explosions come as musicians, film promoters, and tech companies from around the world are gathering in Austin, Texas, for the South by Southwest Conference and Festival. Now, what originally started as a music festival in the 1980s has now evolved and grown over the years to reflect changes to the economic landscape of the city of Austin. The event now includes technology, demos, pitches and panels, interactive experiences, and film screenings. Fortune magazine contributing writer Chris Morris joins us now to talk more about it from Austin. First of all, was there any impact? All right, well, before we get to all the good stuff about South by Southwest, you are there in Austin, and there's been a lot of stuff distracting with these explosions, packages that landed on people's doors, and police definitely are looking into the fact that they're connected. Anybody talking about it, or has it overshadowed the event in any way?
You know, not a lot of talk about that downtown here where I am. Certainly everyone's aware of it, but it's not a chief topic of conversation. I've seen a little bit of an increased police presence. You got to remember, a few years ago at South by Southwest, someone drove a car through a crowd. So they're keeping a real close eye on things. But no one here at the festival itself seems especially worried about that right now.
Okay, well, that's good to know. Lots of exciting things happening. And, of course, we know you are a tech guru. Well, Elon Musk was there, I hear.
Yeah, Elon Musk has been everywhere around South by Southwest this year. He gave a keynote speech. He showed up at a panel for HBO's Westworld and kind of popped up with a question for that. And his keynote was really kind of interesting. He talked about a variety of things. A lot of people had questions about Mars. One of the most interesting things that he had to say was that he expected to send the first mission to Mars in 2019. Now, he didn't say whether that was going to be manned or unmanned, but the fact that we're that close to it is pretty exciting.
And he was over at HBO Westworld?
Yeah, he showed up at the panel where the cast members were talking. But what's really interesting is HBO spent a ton of money for a promotional activity here, which was called South by Southwest World, because they're coming up in season two of their Westworld program. Essentially, they hired over 100 actors to recreate the town of Sweetwater. And it was a pretty phenomenal thing to see. Elon Musk went there. He took his children. I saw Elijah Wood when I was there. And guests got to interact with these actors who acted as the hosts, which are characters in the show. And it was one of the more impressive media stunts I've seen from any media company in all the years I've come here.
Wow, fantastic. So it's a big film festival, and I know Steven Spielberg's got a big one coming up.
Steven Spielberg has got Ready Player One, which comes out later this month. It had its world premiere here this year. Actually had a little bit of a glitch, which was sort of funny. It had the big climax of the movie. They had a little problem with sound, and they had to restart it twice before it finally went. But it's getting good reviews from the people that were there. This is a film that is very much kind of a swan song or a let me try that again. This is very much a film that is like a song to the 1980s. Every little pop culture reference you can imagine is in there, from Back to the Future to the Iron Giant, to things like that. The way it really sort of summarizes this film is Steven Spielberg, when he was talking to the audience, said, "I didn't make a film, I made a movie."
There's so much to see, there's so much to do, there's so much to look at. So far, what has been your favorite thing?
I think it's one of three things, Laurie. It's either A, there's a place that had a whole bunch of puppies up for adoption, so right there, that caught everyone's attention.
Oh, well, yeah.
But it's hard to compete with that.
Yeah,
there was,
I agree.
There was a aerospace company that did a live rocket test that was a little bit off-site. But I think the coolest thing that I saw was, you've heard a lot about 3D printers over the last few years. There is a company that's coming out called Icon that is doing 3D printing of homes. They literally are printing homes that are 600 square feet out of cement. I walked through it. It's a real thing. It was permitted by the city of Austin. And what you're looking at here is a home that cost about $4,000 to make versus however much it costs to make a home in the rest of the world these days. What they're hoping to do with that is, in a few years, go down to South America. Actually, later this year to South America, where there are some housing problems, and actually build a series of 100 or so homes there to help house people.
That's fantastic. That was Fortune magazine contributing writer Chris Morris. Thanks so much. And thank you for joining us on International Edition. That does it for today, but find us anytime at voanews.com. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Laurie London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Earlier this year, the White House deplored the human rights abuses imposed on the Iranian people by their government and pledged not to remain silent when Iranians rose up to peacefully protest against repression and corruption, as White House spokesperson Sarah Sanders made clear.
The United States supports the Iranian people, and we call on the regime to respect its citizens' basic right to peacefully express their desire for change. America longs for the day when Iranians will take their rightful place alongside the free people of the world.
Unfortunately, that day has not yet arrived. Tehran's chief prosecutor has announced that an unidentified Iranian woman who removed her compulsory hijab in public in late December was sentenced to 24 months in prison. The prosecutor said the woman was attempting to encourage corruption by the removal of the hijab in public. The woman was one of dozens arrested in Iran since December for publicly removing their hijabs in defiance of the law, in a nationwide campaign that has alarmed authorities sensitive to any protest after the massive anti-government demonstrations that took place in Iran in December and January. As the protests against the compulsory hijab intensified at the beginning of February, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert expressed support for the Iranian people. "We condemn the reported arrest of at least 29 individuals for exercising their human rights and fundamental freedoms by standing up against the compulsory hijab," she said in a statement. "The United States remains steadfast in our support for the rights of freedom of religion, freedom of expression, and peaceful assembly. People should be free to choose the clothes they wear and practice their faith as they desire. Depriving individuals of this choice undermines their autonomy and dignity." The announcement of the years-long sentence for the Iranian woman who removed her hijab in public came just one day before the observance of International Women's Day. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson had a warning for those societies which, like Iran, still deny women their human rights. "Such conditions deprive individuals, families, and communities of the contributions that empowered women can provide," he said. "Governments that fail to treat women equally do not allow their societies to reach their full potential." And imprisoning courageous women engaged in peaceful protest is a travesty that must be decried.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.